Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. Today I have two educational diagnosticians, people who I assess different special education needs and ADHD. They have got 5 locations in Texas. In the last year alone, they tested 1,200 people. 1 in 3 of them were adult. They've got an experience between adults and children amongst their team. And they've got 40 years of experience between the two of them on identifying dyslexia, ADHD, visual difficulties, all sorts of different challenges. And today I want to introduce you to them and have a really good conversation about the dynamic and the relationship between ADHD and dyslexia, because that's a really interesting overlap and dynamic. And we're going to really discuss this in depth. So I'd really like to introduce you to Laurie Peterson and Dr. Abby Weinstein. It's great to have you, Laurie and Abby, here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Your company's called Diagnostic Learning Services, isn't it?
Yes.
I just think it's just going to be great to step back and kind of reflect on a sort of meta level. You know, you're spending your days in the ground, in the grass, helping people on a direct level. But there's 1,200 people in a year is a lot of people to connect with and then to assess and help direct to what they need. So, you know, let's talk about ADHD and dyslexia. Where do you start? You know, what's your experience of ADHD and dyslexia and the overlap? And also something that maybe you've said before we started talking is the myths of dyslexia and the preconceptions people can come thinking, oh, I've got dyslexia or I've got ADHD, and they might have something different. They just know that there's something not quite the same as the other people, and they're wondering how to work with that. So kick it off. How would you frame this all?
We want to make sure, first of all, that we're all talking about dyslexia as this learning disability that causes difficulties with reading, that is rooted in difficulty understanding the sounds of language, assigning sounds with symbols, manipulating those sounds and words, and overall struggling with what we call phonological processing, processing those sounds and manipulating the sounds that cause difficulty with reading, reading fluently, reading unfamiliar words, decoding new words, and that can impact spelling and writing and comprehension as well. We hear a lot of parents calling in to have their child assessed, or even college age students or adults calling in for assessments. And they talk a lot about, well, I reverse my letters. I transpose letters. I sometimes write backwards. And these are myths, we believe, that have been perpetuated sometimes throughout media, internet, even some teachers perpetuate these myths and say, I think your student, I suspect dyslexia because she's reversing letters, writing backwards. Sometimes parents hear their child complaining of words moving on the page, things bouncing around. And all of those different characteristics are not associated with dyslexia. They have been over time talked about as part of dyslexia, but really dyslexia has more to do with the sounds associated with letters, manipulating those sounds and being able to blend and decode and encode words. So if some reversals are very common in kindergarten, first grade, even through the end of second grade, developmentally, many kids will reverse numbers and letters, but beyond those early stages, that is not a sign of dyslexia. It is actually something more going on that we can assess for that usually involves some visual processing difficulties the way their brain perceives what their eyes are seeing. So we do hear a lot of myths coming in that I think my child has dyslexia because he reverses letters. I think my child has dyslexia because she sees the words moving on the page. And so we also, I think, have a lot of older individuals that think they have dyslexia because they have struggled to retain what they're reading. They often say, I can't recall anything I've just read. I read a whole page. I can't remember anything I've read, or I find myself repeating the same paragraph, losing my place when I'm reading. And they suspect they have dyslexia because of those types of comprehension challenges, rather than actually struggling with reading words at the individual word level or decoding new and unfamiliar words. So we like to make sure that families, clients fully understand what dyslexia is and what dyslexia is not. And then we want to get in and start doing some diagnostic testing to figure out, do they have phonological awareness, this awareness of sounds and manipulation of the sounds in our language? Do they have the ability to attack or decode unfamiliar words? Can they read single words in isolation? Can they read fluently without hesitations, omissions, substitutions at an appropriate rate? And so that helps us get in and really determine, is it truly dyslexia, or is there something else going on that might be impacting comprehension and recall, which oftentimes is an attention deficit disorder, such as ADHD, that causes lack of attention when they're reading and they're not digesting what it is they're reading.
If you go online and you Google, you know, dyslexia, which most parents do before they call us, you'll see that there are places where they'll talk about different types of dyslexia. So the dyslexia that we are talking about is phonological dyslexia. That is the definition by the International Dyslexia Association, where dyslexia impacts your ability to understand phonics, how the words are made up of letters and sounds. There are things that are like surface dyslexia and visual dyslexia. We don't use those terms because we feel like visual dyslexia, if you read the definition, is the letter reversals and the reading backwards, where we have found that to be more of a visual processing deficit. We have optometrists that are specially trained really throughout the US that we refer our families to have that further evaluated and treated. There are things, what's the one, I'm going to not remember it, the one that stealth dyslexia is one that you can read about. And some of those are just really your gifted kids who have compensated and probably do really have good old fashioned phonological dyslexia, but they're so bright, they've covered it up. And so they have stealth dyslexia is kind of where I always feel like that lands us. But I think the different types are confusing. And so we try to bring people back to the main definition that's found on the International Dyslexia Association. That's kind of our gold standard of what dyslexia is. And then that helps them. And really, they come in with that myth and that thinking, but by the time they leave, they understand now what dyslexia is and why their child or why they do or don't have that disorder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Point. So, you know, that's quite a challenging statement to make that Rebecca, you just said, Laurie, you know, the letter reversals, did you just say the letter reversals and the wobbly words are not signs of dyslexia?
Correct.
We did.
Okay. So a lot of people will be challenged by that because they'll say, oh, but I do have letter reversals and wobbly letters. I don't. I've got dyslexia. I don't have either of those. But some people say, I do have that, but I am dyslexic. So how is that right? What would you say to that? I've got an answer, but what would you say to that?
You can have both.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we see that all the time. We have kids that come in with really weak phonological awareness, but also wobbly letters.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the key. This is the co-occurrence of different difficulties and different differences. So, you know, you could be dyslexic and ADHD, you know, but you come in thinking it's all dyslexia, but actually it's the ADHD that's giving you the problem now, or it could be vice versa. You think you're ADHD, and you're doing all the right things for ADHD, but you're still having difficulties, and the difficulties actually arise from a dyslexic difficulty that's co-occurring. So is that what you're saying here?
For sure, for sure. And I think what we see too is that a lot of these kids that do have a co-occurrence, like maybe the school has already identified their dyslexia and they've been put into a specific reading program to address those dyslexic tendencies, right? To remediate, but they're not making any progress. And that's when then parents end up at our office and they say, okay, we've got this dyslexia diagnosis. We're going through this program. We're not making progress. And what we find is that there is something else that's kind of impeding their progress because they still have dyslexia. But if you have a visual processing problem on top of that, it makes reading very hard, regardless of how well you understand phonics. If you have an auditory processing problem, you're not hearing the sounds correctly. So you're not learning the rules that they're teaching you. And if you have an attention problem and you can't pay attention to when this teacher is trying to explain to you the rules and reteach these phonics skills, you're not going to make progress. So understanding that there might be something kind of overlaying that dyslexia diagnosis too, that can really impede progress for kids. And if we address that overlying issue, we find that kids then begin to progress and start filling those gaps and start learning how to read.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's just go from the theoretical to the real world. You know, like I've attributed a great deal of my difficulties to a dyslexia diagnosis. But through this podcast and speaking to a friend, a colleague of mine, Dr. Erica Warren in New York, that I do another podcast with called The Personal Brain Trainer, where we talk about executive function, I'm kind of like, gosh, I think I've got ADHD as well. And I'm like, bloody hell, I don't want to have all this stuff.
And all of this going on.
And you realize that actually it's sometimes worth knowing exactly what the difficulty is so you can actually find the right strategies and hacks for that. And I think for me personally, I would say I've got identified dyslexia and unidentified ADHD. And I'll be honest with you, could someone in my position help me a bit here? Why don't you personally? Someone in my position think, is it worth going and finding whether I've got ADHD as well or not?
Well, I think, like you said, to target the appropriate interventions or strategies to learn, to cope, and to be more successful and to work more efficiently, it is important to know what the issues are. I think there is some positives that come out of that diagnostic label, just knowing, okay, I do have ADHD as well as dyslexia. Now I know that I struggle with some executive functioning skills and attention and focus, concentration, and knowing that can really give you hope and direction for finding the best interventions and coping strategies. For example, if you do have ADHD, learning some great strategies for time management, task initiation, organizational skills, self-regulation skills, putting systems in place that can help you work smarter rather than work harder and be more efficient. So there are some really positives that can come out of knowing that, yes, it is ADHD and it's not just my dyslexia. Even adults that struggle with reading and reading comprehension and retaining information, we oftentimes will end up seeing an ADHD diagnosis in lieu of dyslexia, even though they co-occur very often. You can sometimes it just be ADHD, and then you address the ADHD symptoms and intervene with strategies for coping and learning executive functioning skills.
I think too, in getting that label, it helps the people that you live with, right? So now your wife understands that you're not forgetting to take out the trash because you just don't want to do it. It's because you truly forgot. I feel like it allows a certain level of grace. I also think then you also know too, that it's relatively hereditary. So your daughter, if you were to see some symptoms, you would know right away. I just feel like there's power in knowledge.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So from a diagnostic perspective, what do you do diagnostically to identify ADHD compared to dyslexia? You know, what's behind the testing? It's a little bit mysterious. I've never done an ADHD test myself. I've done a dyslexia one. And also it's quite interesting talking about dyslexia and ADHD because ADHD is within a medical model in the UK and dyslexia is within an educational model. It's a special education need, and ADHD is a medical need. And actually, those two worlds are really very different within the UK. So one you go to the doctor for, and another one you go to an educational psychologist for. And they don't necessarily both do the test, you know? So how does it work within your, I mean, that's a very basic model. I mean, there are some people, I don't know enough about ADHD is what I'm saying, is what's involved in an ADHD test?
So I think that I'm glad that you said that, because we feel like it's important to perform a comprehensive assessment on each student, because A, the reason that they think they might be struggling may not be why they're struggling, but it's important to note all of the areas of issue and figure out what came first, what might be causing what, and what might be coexisting. So to answer your question, we want to look at, for dyslexia, we want to look at phonological awareness. We want to look at their ability to decode words, their reading fluency, their spelling. When we look at attention, we're looking at their ability to, we look at executive functioning skills, we look at working memory and processing speed, we look at objective measures and subjective measures of attention and focus, right? Because like we had talked about earlier, that just because you're not paying attention to something doesn't necessarily mean that you can't pay attention. It might mean that you don't understand it or it's hard for you. And so you tend to, most people would kind of check out. So we want to make sure that if you're not paying attention to something, it's truly because you have an inability, right? A deficit of that attention. So we use not just our observations while we're with the individual working with them over this period of time. We get observations from home, from teachers, from other people in their world. We have them fill out a variety of questionnaires and surveys and symptom inventories. But then we also have an objective measure. That's a test that they take on the computer, and it's approved by the FDA here in the States to measure their ability to maintain focus, attention, distractibility, impulsivity, and even their amount of movement and fidgetiness when given a relatively boring task. And it's a 20-minute test that they take. And I think that for us has been the most fascinating, to really not just get somebody's opinion, but
yes,
to really
that's
see
what
when,
I'm really interested
yeah,
in. You know,
when
like,
we give
okay,
a boring task.
Yes, opinion, external observations, and so on. Because often, not discounting that, but they can indicate underlying things, mm-hmm. but they're not explicitly conclusive on that always, because people create coping strategies and adapt. And so you see that, especially as people get older, you know, they've got an underlying difficulty that they're using all sorts of coping strategies to adapt, and they might not be very good, but they are covering up a bit, you know. Sometimes they might be deflecting questions or saying, what do you think, and so on, and there's all sorts of techniques that we've talked about in this podcast that dyslexics use all the time to deal with some of the difficulties that arise. They're not always the best strategies, but they work. So this objective kind of 20-minute test, that sounds fascinating. Tell us more about that, because I'm sure there's listeners who are thinking, because this is a dyslexia podcast, okay? So a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast right now, you know what we talk about all the time with dyslexia. And, you know, we could maybe have a little bit of a, when are we talking about dyslexia? And then when are we starting to talk about executive function? And when are we starting to talk about ADHD? And when are we talking about something that's maybe co-occurring that isn't dyslexia, that we're maybe attributing to dyslexia? And every guest that we bring on is just sharing their own experience. And we don't necessarily interview tons of experts in the field. We're really talking about people's personal experiences and their life journey, whether they're a dentist or an investment fund manager or whatever. It's just fascinating to hear the personal journey. But coming back to something that's objective, tell us more about this test.
So the test that we use, is it okay for me to share the name of it?
Absolutely,
Okay, it's called the QB test, and it is an FDA-cleared ADHD test that is an objective measure of activity level, attention, sustained attention, and impulsivity. And what it is for ages 6 to 12, it's a 15-minute test. And then from 13 to 60, it's a 20-minute test. And it's a continuous performance test where something is going on the computer screen. It's very boring and monotonous, and shapes are appearing continuously on the screen. And the examinee is taught to press a responder button in their hand when the desired shape appears. They're taught how to do it. They watch a video about doing the test. They take a practice test. We ensure they fully understand how to perform the test and what's being expected of them before they actually start the actual test. But essentially, they are responding or not responding, self-regulating and controlling that impulsive response to a desired shape or an undesired shape. Their activity level is measured by, they wear a headband on their forehead with a reflective ball. And then there's a camera on the front, on the wall in front of them, that uses some infrared technology to pick up on any movement they make throughout that 20-minute duration or that 15-minute duration. But it's also comparing them to a control group. So when the test was developed and researched and normed, they have a control group. And so if I take the test, I'm being compared to a sample of someone my same age, my same sex, that doesn't have difficulties with attention, focus, concentration, activity level, impulsivity. So we're comparing their activity level, first of all, to someone else's in the control group to see if it is at the clinically significant range. We get a percentile ranking during that testing, how much activity they have had, whether it be large gross motor movements, moving, shifting in the chair, to all the way down to little micro movements like bouncing your leg, fidgeting with your free hand, crossing, uncrossing your feet. So we measure their activity level from this test. The test also looks at attention in three different ways: in response time, to responding to the desired shapes, in your response time variability throughout the performance of the test. Can you pay attention in the beginning of the test, but then it's hard for you to sustain your attention as the test progresses and gets more boring? And then we also look at omissions, not responding at all when those desired shapes, how many omissions did you omit while you were not paying attention, possibly? And so it gives us overall an attention score based on three different measures, comparing us to a control group. And we're looking to see, is that attention in the clinically significant range? And then impulsivity and response style. Did you respond impulsively and have a lot of errors? Did you have a lot of responses where you hit the button before the shape ever even appeared on the screen, which are anticipating the shape appearing and being a little happy with the response button and clicking away? And so we get those three measures scored in percentile rankings: the activity level, the attention level, and the impulsivity level. And we use that data as some very important objective data. It is important to get someone's opinion of their skills and their struggles, and maybe even someone in their personal life. If it's a child, we look at their parents' input. If it's teachers' input, on adults, we sometimes will get observer input, like a spouse, coworker, roommate. So the subjective measures are important as well and give us a lot of information and help drive some of the interventions as well. But having that objective measure combined with the subjective measure has been really enlightening for us in diagnosing ADHD, because a lot of times before we had the objective measure, we were just basing it on our observations and the client's self-report or their parents' report of what they're observing. And there are people out there that have some weaknesses in their executive functioning skills, but it's not to a marked degree, or it's not impacting them in more than one setting, or they can pay attention and sustain their attention, but they just struggle with organization or task initiation, for example. So it has been really enlightening for us to see you can have some characteristics of ADHD and not have all of the characteristics, or not meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. Once we look at, well, you were able to sustain your attention very well on a boring task for 20 minutes, even though you say you struggle with working in a noisy environment.
I think too, what I really like about this test is it gives you a really nice visual. I like visual, and it gives you the graph of the clients or the examinees responses. And then it gives you the graph from the control group. So it's really great to say in 20 minutes, you know, kind of, this is what you looked like in during a boring task. And this is what we would say some like a neurotypical or a non-ADHD person would look like. Or if you were to take medication, because what happens and why FDA has been a part of it is that it's approved to use for medication management. So if somebody decides to go get on medication for their ADHD and they come back in and want to take the test again, the goal would be that their chart, their responses looks more like the control group and less like somebody with ADHD if the medication is doing what it's supposed to. We had my stepdaughter is ADHD and is on medication. And when we first got this test, we used her as a guinea pig because we just wanted to try it out. And lo and behold, her impulsivity was pretty high on her medicine. And we had seeing some things going on, but we didn't really process it until we saw that. And then we used that to take back to her doctor to adjust her medication, which has been awesome for her.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. So let me just pause on that, because you already knew she was ADHD. She was already on medication to help with the ADHD. And then you did the test, not just to identify the ADHD, but identify if the medicine was working or not, or how well it was. And then you tweak the medicine and you could see it in the test going back to the norm.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. And we actually, we have a lot of clients that come in that are on medication, and sometimes it's not even ADHD medication. We've had clients that have come in that have been on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, and you can see the impact that it makes on that test, that it does in some places can help with sustained attention, or it may reduce some of their impulsivity. And it's been incredibly fascinating. And, you know, we're learning every day and seeing new cases and having new questions, but I think it's really helped our diagnostic process immensely.
Definitely.
Fascinating. That's lovely to hear about. And how long has it been? So what would be interesting, right, is if we use our typical four questions about what was life like before, what was the wake up call, what was the main challenge, and what was the reward in terms of dyslexia? Let's look at it in terms of ADHD here, you know, like before this diagnostic test and after. When did you get the diagnostic test?
It's been almost a year.
Oh, is that all?
That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow. So why is it just a year? Is this brand new or what? So what woke you up to this test, and why?
Interestingly, there have been other tests on the market that are exactly the same, use the same system basically to test. It's called continuous performance. And I had some experience probably 10 years ago in a psychology office where the psychologist had a similar test. That test required the student to identify the difference between an 8-pointed star and a 10-pointed star. Maybe not those numbers, but along those lines. And what I found is, because not to circle back to our visual processing kids, we have so many kids that we see that have visual processing issues, and it's just, we see them because they're coming in for academic concerns. I don't know that it's that common in the general population, but the kids that we see, it's common. And we had kids getting misdiagnosed by that test because they couldn't tell the difference between an 8 and a 12-pointed star. So they were looking very inattentive, yet it was more because they couldn't do the test. And I didn't want to go down that road. I wanted to make sure that whatever tool we had would not impact kids who are colorblind or, I mean, any of those things. And so we really waited until there was a tool that we felt like was very unbiased and would give us the most accurate information. And so we really worked hard prior to this test to gather as much data from the family. We look at processing speed and working memory scores in their testing, and we still use all of those tools. Now we just have this one more piece that I really think that's really benefits the client more than anything, because instead of them thinking it's just, well, was it because it's how I filled out that survey? Or is it, you know, was it because how my teacher filled out the survey? Well, yeah, but it's also now how you performed on this test. And they know immediately. They're like, oh yeah, that test was terrible. That was so hard. Mm-hmm. No, it was so boring.
Right.
We've had kids fall asleep taking it. It's really boring. And your ADHD and kids adult. Are out. Yeah. We've had adults. It just. So that is why we waited to get it.
And I think it's also nice that we've been giving Lori and I together have been administering many of these intellectual standardized tests for a very long time. So we've also learned about different subtests or different tasks on this test that require a lot of attention and concentration. So we, back to that comprehensive assessment, we have many different aspects of our evaluation that we can really look at and see where an individual was struggling. And did they struggle on the tasks that do weigh heavily on attention and concentration or working memory, immediate recall, manipulation of holding information in your mind? So it is great that we've understood these tests and given these tests for a long time so that we can understand which tasks are ones that typical people with ADHD typically tend to perform poorer on. So in addition to the ADHD objective measures, the ADHD subjective measures, we like to look at all of their major intellectual processing areas and how they perform on these standardized intellectual assessments. So we can look at working memory and processing speed and even some academic areas such as reading comprehension, where they have to immediately recall details from something they've just read, and then versus being able to read something multiple times, go back to it and then answer questions about it.
I think we've learned to identify the different patterns too. For dyslexia as well, it's fascinating when we have a student and we look at the pattern of how they score on different things. Even kids, because here's the thing is that we have a lot of kids that come in that are incredibly bright, gifted, mm-hmm. but you still see some of those same patterns, maybe at a higher level, but the patterns are still there to where they're superior in their problem-solving skills, which then tells me that, well, then they're probably going to have a strategy to solve these working memory problems to where somebody with an average intelligence or a little lower is going to really struggle on those if they can't pay attention, where you see them apply these strategies because they're so incredibly bright. So sometimes I had a student come who was the valedictorian of his school, of a giant school here in North Texas. And he had been to two different doctors, but because he was so bright, they said there was no way he had ADHD because he just scored so high. And I didn't have this test when this objective measure, but when I worked with him, you know, we went through the testing and I realized that yes, he's incredibly bright, but so you've got to look at it relative, right? He still showed all the patterns and he still was struggling with all those executive functioning skills. And so he was so frustrated and now experiencing depression, anxiety, because he felt like nobody was listening to him. So you really have to look. And I think Abby and I have gotten really good at looking at all of the information. And I think that's so important. You can't just look at one piece because you may miss something.
That's right. Fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing that. So just 1 year you've been using it. And out of interest, how much does it cost people to do a test like an ADHD test?
Well, it depends where you go. For our evaluation, I feel like we're relatively inexpensive, comparatively speaking, to prices across the US for a full evaluation. So for our comprehensive evaluation, it ranges anywhere from $1,300 to $1,500 in that ballpark. And I think US dollars. And I feel like we've heard people say they've been quoted in the $4,000 and $5,000 range, which is crazy to me. But you know, our theory has always been that we would rather help more kids at a lower and adults at a little bit lower rate, because that's what we do. Our goal is just to help people figure out what's going on and get the right kind of help, you know, cover our costs. We're not doing this to become bazillionaires. Mm-hmm. But our goal is just, we want to reach more people. So it's still a lot of money to a lot of people, but compared to what is out there, I feel like we're on the definite lower end.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices.
So can people, like, just looking at the ADHD, because you're that price is for the full comprehensive, can people come back and say, I want to do that test, that attention testing again to see if my medication's working? Can they kind of come back and do that?
Yes. And if they have already been with us, we typically don't charge them to come back and do that again, just that one test. If it's a doctor's office sending us or sending someone over or somebody that just wants to do a medication check, it's about $150. It's not very expensive.
Okay.
Relative.
That's fascinating.
And the great part about this test, I should mention, is that we can also offer it. There is an online version. So if you wanted to take this test, we could send you a link. You would do it on your laptop as long as it has a video camera. It's a little bit different than doing it in our office, but they have an online version. And so we are able to also use this test, not just for the clients that come into our office, but for anybody that we assess virtually.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to do that test.
We would be happy to have you do it.
Yeah. That would be good fun.
That would be interesting.
It actually isn't fun. It's really boring, it would be good to have the information.
Because, okay, here I'm going to start. Let me be a little bit challenging here, okay? And I'm just speaking on behalf of people who are listening and maybe saying, Darius, you need to ask them this sort of thing. Because I'm not trained like you guys are. I'm very much from a parent's perspective and actually a tutor's perspective, you know, because I run Bullet Map Academy and we tutor children with dyslexia and ADHD on how to write stories with mind mapping process. So here's the thing. Dyslexia and ADHD often co-occur. And sort of speaking to people or just vaguely, I think there's probably somewhere around about a 40% co-occurrence. Would you say that's about right for people who have a dyslexia identification? 40% of them probably have ADHD as well, or is it more or is it less? What would you put it at?
I would say 40% is about accurate in the States as well, as far as the comorbidity of ADHD and dyslexia.
Okay. So let's say, you know, it's also fascinating. I was looking at some British research by the government on this, because dyslexia is a disability in the UK, and I think it's also a disability in the USA. I don't think it's a disability listed in Australia yet, but it's a disability, and it comes with certain responsibilities for governments and businesses in terms of making it accessible. There's also dysgraphia, for example. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating because the government paper was saying, we're not going to list dysgraphia as a separate entity here because it has over an 80% co-occurrence with dyslexia. That it's just like, you know, if you've got dyslexia, you probably got some degree of dysgraphia at the same time. So I only mentioned that not just to go it was just a small comment in a government report, but it was just fascinating how much they noticed the co-occurrence of dysgraphic difficulties with dyslexia. So there's comes a level that when dyslexia co-occurs with something else so much, it might as well just come together. So this, my question is, where would you say are these kind of co-occurrence levels? That would be fascinating. You know, you've got dyslexia co-occurring with ADHD, co-occurring with visual stress, etc. Where would you say the common co-occurrences are?
I mean, I think that the ADHD dyslexia is probably the most common, but I also think kids with ADHD probably have about the same percentage chance of having another type of learning disability. I think dyslexia is probably the highest, but I think that kids with ADHD can also have a math disability. They can have dysgraphia. Mm-hmm. They can also have a written expression, which is different than the dysgraphia, just their ability to get their thoughts on paper. So I feel like that the comorbidity with ADHD is pretty strong. With dyslexia, we don't see as high of a comorbidity with the dysgraphia. We see a much more, you know, 40% with the ADHD. I think that what we try to educate parents on with the dysgraphia is that, and we did a whole podcast of our own on this, on the dyses, because just because they all start with dys doesn't mean they're related. And that dysgraphia is more of a graphomotor, fine motor, handwriting, manipulating your pencil and all those kinds of things. We don't see, I mean, Abby, would you agree?
I would agree. I was thinking the same thing. I don't think we're not seeing,
you don't see it as high as that. Yeah.
I'm not seeing dyslexia and dysgraphia co-occurring nearly as much as dyslexia and ADHD. And I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that individuals with dyslexia, it does translate into some of their difficulties with writing, and especially with spelling within the context of their writing. But thinking about dysgraphia, most individuals that we assess for dyslexia, they may struggle with spelling and it may interfere with some of the readability of their writing, but their writing is very neat and legible, and they don't struggle with letter formation and spacing and writing on the line and writing with in the margins and a lot of those other dysgraphic characteristics. Now, it can co-occur, and it for sure has shown evidence of that in students we've evaluated, but we're not seeing that comorbidity nearly as high as what you read in that research article.
Interesting. Okay.
Very interesting. Dys is difficulty with, you know, those dyscalculia is also another one that we hear parents calling in. My child has dyslexia, so I suspect he probably has dysgraphia and maybe even dyscalculia, which is a math disability. And really the most common trait amongst all of those disabilities is that they start with DYS, that root, which means difficulty with. And so that's where they have commonalities, is that they start with difficulty with math calculations, difficulty with motor planning and writing, or difficulty with language and reading. In fact, ADHD, sorry to go off for a second, I think we see many more individuals that struggle with math when they have ADHD more than struggling with writing and reading. Would you agree, Lori?
I would totally agree. Math is that, I always call it the 14 story, 15 story building. And it just, every year it builds on it. It's so cyclical. Those facts, those skills keep coming around every year. And if you are not paying attention and not digesting those lower foundations, those lower years, if you're missing something, if you have a hole, every time it comes back around, you're going to struggle. And then immediately, it doesn't take long before you decide you're terrible at math. You hate math. Well, and then you're not going to be good at math if you've already decided you're bad at it. And so we see that with our ADHD kids, that if it's not an inability to do math, it's just, there are some gaps that need to be filled. And, but they've already gotten so far off the path that they've already decided that they, you know, they hate math, mm-hmm. they're failing math, but it's really all from the root of their inattention and missing those skills. With reading, we don't see that as often, because with reading, yes, those lower foundation skills are important, but somehow the kids, even when you're not paying attention, they reteach differently than they do with math. It fascinates me, and it probably could be a whole like dissertation study, research study, but we see much more difficulty in math with our ADHD kids. It's very common.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Working memory. Let's talk about working memory. Okay. Because in the British Dyslexia Association, often when they're teaching about difficulties with dyslexia, they're talking about difficulties with processing and working memory. And you're using working memory separately from dyslexia, and I'm in your language. And I'm just trying to clarify where you're placing working memory difficulties, because often, for example, a person with a dyslexia diagnosis often has working memory difficulties, and a huge amount of their problems come from the smaller working memory. And so it could be a co-occurrence dynamic that's happening here, where they have some phonological difficulties, but they've overcome them through strategies of learning to read, but they've still got working memory difficulties that are now kept following them up into their teenage years or even adult years, which are affecting writing and planning and things like that, because working memory is the overlap onto executive function. So where do you place working memory within a dyslexia identification and in relation to ADHD?
We look at working memory for sure on every individual that we are assessing for dyslexia. We test for it in a couple of different ways, and we look at it. But as far as diagnosing dyslexia, we follow the diagnostic criteria set forth by the Texas Education Agency, or the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, or the International Dyslexia Association, depending on where we're evaluating the individual from. And one of the qualities or one of the characteristics or the diagnostic criteria for that diagnosis does not mention anything about working memory, even though we know working memory does impact individuals with dyslexia, and it is very important for their success in intervention in going through a dyslexia therapy program. They're going to be more successful in that program the stronger their working memory skills are. But I'm not seeing a ton of individuals diagnosed with dyslexia with deficits in working memory, surprisingly. You know,
it's very interesting that you brought that up too, because here local in our state, and I don't know that it's still the case, but I know for a very long time, if a student was diagnosed with dyslexia or they had the characteristics, but they had weak working memory, poor working memory, they wouldn't place them. They wouldn't go forward with the diagnosis and place them into the dyslexia program because in their mind, they needed adequate working memory, whatever adequate is, to be successful in that program. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that. That was the statement.
I don't either.
But I do feel like they have
public schools.
Yeah, I do feel like maybe they've moved away from that a little bit. I'm not sure. I haven't heard because some things have changed in our state as far as identifying dyslexia goes. But I would have to let parents know that, you know, I absolutely think that your child has dyslexia, but when you take this to the school, you may get some pushback because they also have weak working memory and they are going to feel like that they won't be successful in the program because it requires you to be able to have adequate working memory. And I absolutely think you're right. I do think that working memory plays a huge part of reading. And I think the research tells you that. And weak working memory just impedes that ability. It exacerbates it.
Mm-hmm. It's harder to learn the strategies and the reading rules and the phonics rules that most dyslexia therapy intervention programs teach if you do have poor working memory skills. Not to say that you can't learn those strategies and skills, because I've seen many, many children and adolescents and adults be successful. But what it is that schools were saying, if you don't have average intelligence or above, or you don't have average or above working memory skills, you aren't going to be successful in this dyslexia program because it's memorizing so many different reading rules and strategies and the foundational principles and phonics strategies and rules within our English language. However, kids can make progress. It just may be a little bit slower than what we'd like to see. With weak working memory skills, it may take them twice as long to get through the full curriculum program of one of the dyslexia-based intervention programs.
Okay, I'm going to ask another tough question that parents would probably be thinking here, okay, which is, isn't it sometimes really difficult for parents when there's so many quite narrow definitions of these, you know, slices, that they're like, this might be splitting hairs between this and between this and between that. And what happens is sometimes, I'll give you an example, parents, teachers often say, oh yes, your child's got processing difficulties, okay? And, but they've not got dyslexia. And the parent's like, well, I don't understand what to do about this. And, you know, so sometimes from a parent's point of view, it's just easier to say, look, they've got dyslexia, difficulties that come with dyslexia is basically what they're saying, or they've got ADHD and difficulties that come with ADHD. But sometimes when experts like you, or maybe teachers who are being super precise, they're like, oh, no, they don't have dyslexia, but they've got some processing difficulties. The parent's like, well, okay, you've just maybe pushed them out of the dyslexia help bucket into a non-existent help bucket and so forth. And it's a way of, sometimes from a parent's point of view, it can feel like I'm just being confused all the time. And a person who's confused always loses because they say no. If your brain, when it's confused, just says no. I'm just, I'm not acting. I'm confused. I'm not acting. No. An organization that's confused says no. A person that says is looking at a website that's confused and just says no. Whatever, no. If it's simple, straightforward, understandable, and actionable, they have a more tendency to do something about it. And I've noticed a lot of parents are really confused by when experts say, oh, they've got a processing difficulty compared to dyslexia. What's your take on all of that? Help me navigate that. Yeah. What would you say to parents in that setting?
Well, you know, we get that call a lot where I think my child has a processing issue or they've been diagnosed with processing issues. And that is a very vague term, right? Mm-hmm. There's a name for whatever they have 99% of the time, if there is a processing issue. And so we want to be very specific with parents. I can't think of anybody we've tested where they've had a score in the processing skills that was low, or they demonstrated some sort of processing deficit that didn't correlate with some kind of diagnosis. Not a diagnosis of just generic processing issues. It's impacting something. It's impacting something, whether it's truly dyslexia or another kind of reading disability. You know, you can have a learning disability in reading comprehension, you know, and so we want to make sure that we're giving them the right diagnosis so they get the right help. A diagnosis of dyslexia for somebody who truly isn't dyslexic is really, it can be really detrimental, because putting that person, that child, into a dyslexia program, if they don't have dyslexia, will be the most boring thing they've ever done. They will feel stupid because they're going back and relearning A, Apple, A, and they get that. And the way that it's taught won't speak to their brain. So we want to be very careful that the kids that we're referring to those kinds of programs are going to be a good fit. But if they have another processing issue, we want to figure out why. And I think that's what's very different about what we do, is that we don't just stop and say, oh, look, you've got slow processing speed. Good luck. Why? Why was their processing speed low? And if we look at it from different, was it just when they did this one task, or was it when they did anything that was timed? And we want to look for generalities and patterns to figure out what's causing them to work at that pace. And then what do we do about it? And how do they get the right kind of help? So we make sure that they know about things like interactive metronome therapy, which is a therapy that can help improve processing speed. We want to know about accommodations they can receive in school and how they can get extra time to finish their tests and what that looks like. And so for us, that's not really where we stop. I would never stop at just, you got a processing problem. We want to know why, and what can we call it so that now you know, because like we talked about a little while ago, the name, the diagnosis helps you drive the solution. And we want to make sure that they have that name to find the right solution.
I find that that's such a helpful answer. Thank you for that answer. Because I think that's often what's happening in schools, that the teacher is happy to stop at, oh, they've got a processing difficulty, and they just stop there. What you're saying is, no, that's a good first sort of flag that there's a difficulty, but you need to go all the way to finding what specifically it is, so you can have a specific targeted solution.
Yep. Why? Why is that processing area weak?
Love it.
Exactly.
Love it. Great.
And what is it impacting is important also. You know, if you do have weak processing, what areas is it impacting in your life? And that's going to also help drive the interventions and recommendations.
Well, you're bringing up another big question here, is that parents who know that there's maybe a learning difficulty or something, or an attention difficulty somewhere, and they want to find an answer. What's it like in America in terms of getting tests done? Is it, because I sometimes think that you could maybe go to one specialist who specializes in one area of identification, but doesn't look at the others. And I don't know enough, to be quite honest, of what it's like in America. I'm just wondering, what is it like, and how do people make decisions as to who they go to for assessment?
Well, I think first and foremost, I wanted to talk about our schools do a pretty good job of catching students that are struggling and making sure they're getting appropriate interventions before ever being evaluated to determine if there is a specific learning disability or some sort of disability. Our schools have grown tremendously in the fact that they are constantly figuring out which kids are struggling and how to intervene. And they're making sure that those interventions are research-based interventions. Even in the typical classroom, they're constantly assessing the students, trying to figure out who's behind, who's on point and making adequate grade level progress, and they're getting interventions. And then if they are not responding appropriately to those interventions, then that's when they are referred for some diagnostic testing. So many, many families are getting diagnostic testing in the school settings, in public schools, charter schools, and the schools are required to, they have to identify any students with learning disabilities. And if they don't, they can get in trouble for failing to identify students with learning disabilities and to provide appropriate interventions. So then there's families that don't want to go through the school system because there's a long timeline that the school takes to evaluate the students, or they want an unbiased opinion outside of the schools and they don't want the teacher's opinion or another school staff member's opinion. Or there's those individuals that are in private schools or they're homeschooled and they don't have access to all of those school services. So they oftentimes look to private practices, and we're really big on early identification because of how important early intervention is. So we are, you know, assessing kids really starting about 5 or 6. We'd like to see they've had at least half a year of kindergarten, so we know that they've had some formal instruction with the phonics-based curriculum, for example, and those early level foundational skills. So we're seeing a lot more younger clients and a lot of parents calling in with young students that are struggling. So I think it's good, and the schools are doing a better job at screening earlier for dyslexia, for example. They're starting to screen them now by the end of kindergarten year or the middle of first grade year. So there is a lot more evidence of appropriate interventions going on, appropriate thorough evaluations. We like to do what we do in the private setting because we feel like we look more thoroughly at everything, and we look at a preponderance of evidence, and we don't just follow simple steps and guidelines that maybe the school laid out. But there are a lot of evaluations being done now in the school setting and in the private setting for students of all ages. Even some colleges are offering assessments.
I think when a parent decides to go ahead and do that private evaluation for any one of those reasons, it's fascinating. And in Texas, it might be different than in other states, but we do get calls from across the country where, you know, they talk to their friends and they talk to their, you know, other professionals, and they use the internet, but I don't know that they always know where to go. I think your question is a great question, because I don't know that they know where to go sometimes. And we get calls for things that we don't test for, and we're very honest about that. And we help them try to find the right people to do that. But I think sometimes I don't think there's enough information out there for parents to make an educated decision sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're blindsided also. They may have not heard that their child has been struggling. They see maybe decent grades coming home on schoolwork. They haven't heard from the teacher that their child's struggling. And then all of a sudden it's maybe halfway through second semester of the school year, and they hear in a parent teacher conference, your child has been struggling. We suspect there might be a learning disability, and we want to test them to see if they would be eligible for special education services, for example, or to determine if they have a learning disability. So I've heard parents, you know, oftentimes call to us in the private setting to say, I have no idea what's going on because I thought my child was doing fine. Now all of a sudden the school wants to test them for special education services. And so I want to figure out what is going on with my child and determine if there is a true learning disability and if the school's on the right track.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. It's been we could keep talking and talking, but we've got to stop at some point, don't we?
Right.
It's just been wonderful to just go on that journey of discovery and really hear about that ADHD test. I think there'll be a lot of people who are fascinated by that and will want to know more about what they can do. You know how I'm going to do it. Can others come in and dip their toe, or do they have to go for the big all round one? Is there an intermediate step is what I'm asking?
Yeah, they can definitely dip their toe. So, you know, you never want to make a diagnosis just based on one test. Yes. You know, that's just unethical. Really. So that what we do have, especially for adults, really more of just an ADHD only. So we still look at some of those cognitive processes because that's an important piece. We don't do any of the academic testing. We really just look at the cognitive processes, the surveys, and the objective ADHD measure. So it's a much, there's much less to it. It's a shorter test. It doesn't take as much time and it's, you know, half of our normal fee. So, we do offer that for adults, especially if they're not going, anyone who's going back to school or who is in school, who feels like they may want to access accommodations and supports, they're going to need the full evaluation because the school is going to want to see how the ADHD is impacting them academically and why they need these accommodations. But if you just want to, A, find out if you have it and maybe get on medication or seek treatment, then our kind of condensed ADHD only evaluation is sufficient.
Fascinating. Well, all the links in the description below. And you know, Laurie and Abby have got their own podcast as well. So you could abandon this podcast and go to their podcast.
You could just add it to your list.
I'm only joking. I'm very happy to put that in the link below to as well. Just swipe up and you'll see the links below on whatever device you're using. You'll see it in the show notes. So Abby and Laurie, it's been great to have you here talking about dyslexia and ADHD. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. And thank you everyone for listening.
See you later.
See you later.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.